Board Game Bros.
Hello, listeners.
Hey, everybody.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. And we got a regularly scheduled weekly episode where we're going to talk about one game in particular. We're going to talk about how to play it, how to win at it, and we're going to talk about the design of the game. So, Matthew, what game are we talking about today?
We are talking about Tiny Epic Kingdom, designed by Scott Alms and published in 2014 by Gamelin Games.
All right. So just for a short, quick description of what Tiny Epic Kingdoms is about. In Tiny Epic Kingdoms, as the leaders of fantasy factions, players collect resources, travel to new regions, unlock magical abilities, build monuments, and expand their population. Once one of the endgame conditions are met and the remaining turns are played out, points are totaled from each player's accomplishments, and the player with the most points wins. That's the short of it, but it's a little more complicated than that, a little more detailed. So let's get into a more detailed description of what the gameplay looks like in Tiny Epic Kingdoms, and then we're going to start talking about the strategy. So,
yes,
Tiny Epic Kingdoms. So every player at the start of the game will have a faction. Like I mentioned before, you're the leader of some sort of faction. Based on a fantasy race, and each faction has five magical abilities that distinguish it from the other factions, and you unlock these abilities over the course of the game by spending mana, which is one of the three resources in this game. There's two other things you can do to sort of advance your civilization, which is I called it building a monument in the short description to sort of contextualize it, but in the game they just call it like upgrading your tower. They just call it your tower. And you spend ore, that's one of the other resources, to upgrade your tower, which just gives you points. And then the last thing you can do to expand your civilization is to increase your population. In this game, that's called expanding. And you spend food, the third resource, to do that. So those are your goals, is to do these things while also traveling around a map, which is created by four map cards, one per player.
In a four-player game.
In a four-player game. Yeah, it's made up of a number of map cards, I should say. Each map has a number of regions on them. And I'll let you take it away, Matthew. You've got the game in front of you to get a little more detailed into like the whole process of the game, how the game plays out,
right,
and such.
So each region can be one of five types. There are the forests, which provide mana. There's the plains, which provide food. The mountains, which provide ore. And then there is a castle, which will give you extra points if you have a meeple there at the end of the game. And there is the ruins, which provide any resource when you gain resources, but they will be riskier if you leave meeples there at the end of the game.
Because so, they're worth 0 points.
Right.
If they're there.
So the way you actually gain resources and take actions is through these is through an action selection card. So it goes around the table with each player taking a turn to be the active player, and the active player selects one of the six actions on that card from what is available. And when they do so, they place a little shield down to show that that action has been taken. And when five shields have been placed, so mm-hmm. there will be one action unused, you clear off the shields, and the whole board becomes usable again. From top to bottom, these actions are patrol, where you move one of your workers to an adjacent region on the same card they currently are in. There is quest, where you move a worker from a region on the edge of a card to a region on another edge of a card, or the edge of another card. So you can move to other cards this way. There is build, which is building your tower by spending ore. There's research, which is researching your mana or your magic by spending mana. And there's expand, which is making a new meeple by spending food. And notably, you cannot, or when you expand, you have to put the meeple on a space with one of your existing meeples. and there could only be at most two meeples on a given region. So you would have to move a meeple from the start to do so, because you start by placing two meeples on a single region. And then the last action is trade, where you get to trade any amount of one resource into that same amount of another resource. So you could trade three ore into three food, or, you know, two mana to two food, and such like that.
Mm-hmm.
And now, if you are not the active player, instead of taking the action that they chose, you can collect resources. You get one resource per region you control. So if all of your meeples are on different regions, each one will produce a resource for that region. But any region of yours that has two meeples will only produce one resource.
Important to point out that that the way this game works is that the active player will choose an action, and then every other player has the option of taking that action or collecting resources.
Right.
So it's not just the action of the active player. Everyone does what the active player chooses. It's just the active player will take the action first.
And they'll only be able to do that.
Right, the active player cannot choose to gather resources on their turn. So the active player will take the action, and then in turn order, every other player will decide whether they take that action and how they take it, or whether they collect resources.
Right, and now there is one important thing that can happen as a result of movement, which is wars.
Mm-hmm.
If you move a meeple into the region of another meeple, then you go to war with that player. You mean another player's meeple. And so when you go to war with somebody, first, each player gets these D12s that have sides 1 through 11, and mm-hmm. then a little flag. And this is just sort of like your way to secretly wager war cost.
Yeah, this is a lot like the wagering in Scythe,
yeah.
or My Little Scythe.
After each player's made their wagers, you reveal. Each player pays their war cost, and then whoever has the higher number on that die wins the fight. I say mm-hmm. war cost because each resource does something different in war. Mana provides 2 war cost for that, and ore provides 1. So say if you wagered 5, you could spend 2 mana and 1 ore, which would be 5 war points. Or you could spend 3 ore in 1 mana, or etc.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you lose a fight, then you have a choice to make. You can either let that meeple you had die, which means you return it to your supply of meeples. Or you could save it by paying food equal to the number of meeples you have, which, by the way, is the cost of a new meeple, is the number of meeples you have after placing that meeple. And when you do so, it moves to an adjacent region on the same card. And if there's no, and you can't do this if it would start a war.
Right.
If there are no regions you can move to that are empty, or have your own meeples in this case, then you can move that meeple you save to another card on the edge of that card.
Right. As essentially, if you're requesting. You just pay food and the meeple retreats rather than dies.
Now, if
you mentioned the cost of expanding, I think it's important to go over.
I wasn't done with war.
Okay, go ahead.
Now, the flag is sort of a zero, but if both players wager the flag, then they form an alliance. This means that their meeples can coexist on that space, and as long as they have one space that shares their meeples, they'll be in an alliance. While in an alliance, when they move another meeple to the other player's region, they can just say, I'll stay with the alliance, or I'll stay at peace, and you can still share that space. But if you instead move another meeple to the other player's region and you don't stay at peace, then you can break the alliances and start another war, and then do another war on the place where you previously had an alliance. So alliances can be...
When you choose to when you choose war, when you're in an alliance,
no, you're right.
It's a single war for the fate of the whole kingdom.
I forgot about that. So you fight one war, but you have multiple meeples that can die.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be really risky.
It should also be said that defenders win ties in war. Okay, so you mentioned the cost of expansion.
Yeah, let's go over those three actions and what they cost.
Right, so there's three important actions for growing your kingdom. There's research, which increases your magic, building, which builds up your tower, and expanding, which gives you more meeples. Each one of them costs one of the basic resources, and this is also how you end the game.
Yeah.
When one player reaches the end, you know, the limit of any of these upgrade pathways, then that will trigger the end of the game. And at the end of the game, players just continue to take turns until all of the shields have been used. And then that is when the game ends and points are tallied. So upgrading, you start out at like tower level zero, magic level zero, and with two meeples on the board. And whenever you make an upgrade, you have to pay, essentially you pay a number of resources equal to the level of magic or tower that you are attempting to achieve, or you pay an amount of food equal to the amount of meeples that are going to be on the board after you expand your population.
Right. So the first level of tower and magic costs one, the next one will cost two of their respective resources. And like we said earlier, if you're trying to make your third meeple, then it will cost three food. And your fourth meeple would cost four food.
Right. So there's five levels of magic. There's six levels to your tower. And there's a total of seven meeples. You start with two, so there's five potential meeples to add to the board.
Right.
Plus more if you ever lose any in war.
And now one last thing for setup that I want to mention is that when you're setting up the game, each player can choose what resources they want to start with in any combination totaling six resources. But there is a recommended starting resource, which is one ore, two mana, three food.
Right.
Yeah. So keep that in mind as we go into gameplay and all that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, well, that's about the end of gameplay, but going into strategy, that's pretty much it for gameplay. It's just you start with two meeples on the board. The active player will choose an action. This role rotates, and in turn order, players take those actions or gather resources, and you move your units around. You make your upgrades. You fight wars, and then when one of the end game conditions is met, game ends. Points are totaled. The points that you get in this game, you get 1 point for every level of magic that you researched. You get 1 point for every meeple on the board, except for the meeples in the ruins. Those are lost, and they're worth 0 points. You take them off the board before scoring happens.
Mm-hmm.
The tower, depending on what level you achieve, they give you different amounts of victory points. For the first, I want to say, three levels, you're at a deficit for like level to point ratio. But as you hit the higher levels of tower, 4, 5, and 6, they start to be worth more. I think is a level 4 tower worth 5 points or 4 points?
I think it goes 0, 1, 2, 4, 7, 10, 14. I don't have it in front of me, actually, I can't check right now.
I believe it stops at 10.
Okay.
I believe it goes 10, 7, and then I imagine 4 is worth 4. And so it'll go 0, 1, 2, 4. 0, 1, 2, 4, 7. I don't know. Either way, once you reach tower level 4 or higher, then you're starting to like be at parity with the points that you would have gotten from leveling up magic, or you'll be above it. Like level 5, I'm pretty sure when your tower's level 5, you get 7 points.
Right.
Which now you're getting a profit in points to levels.
Exactly.
And then in addition to all that, you get 2 points for your castle
if you're controlling
a castle on the map,
and then every faction's fifth level of magic gives them bonus points for different rules based on which faction it is.
After all those are totaled up, you see who has the most points. There's a number of tiebreakers, and I think they essentially just go through the advancements to see who is further in those advancements. Like between the tied individuals, whoever had the highest level magic, then the highest level tower, then the most meeples. And then eventually it'll just say it's a tie if everything is still even after all those. All right, so let's talk strategy.
All right. So
why is mana so good, Matthew?
Okay, so mana is the best resource, and by extension, forests are the best terrain. So first of all,
tell people why.
So first off, mana gives you new abilities that like strictly make your faction better. So that right there is good, just because, you know, upgrading magic is something every faction wants to do. And it gives you these cool things, it makes you stronger, it gives you more options, etc. Helps you break resource and turn parity. So, like, you know, it's one of those things where if it takes a turn to collect resources, then something that saves you resources can save you a turn. One of those things. Mm-hmm. Also, magic is the quickest way to end the game, because it is quicker than ore, and has a quicker, or it's quicker than ore in terms of how many tiers you have to go through, mm-hmm. and it is cheaper than meeples, which still have 5 meeples you have to get from what you start with, but are much more expensive because you start at 3 instead of starting at 1.
Right.
And since tier 5 of magic can give you like upwards of 4 points, maybe, it can be a huge swing if you get to that point. And mana produces the most war points per resource, so that's also pretty good.
Right. So mana is super valuable because of all these reasons. It ends the game quickest, it's best at war, and it adds the most value when you spend it, because you're getting bonus actions in addition to accruing points. You're getting these bonus abilities for your faction.
Right. And since every faction's 4th tier ability is usually pretty strong anyways, like, it kind of automatically threatens ending the game for a lot of factions.
Right. Reaching that 4th level puts you in a good position to just take it over the finish line.
Yeah. So that's like the big central part of playing this game, is either controlling forests or fighting wars for forests, trying to keep people down.
This game, I don't know if we mentioned this in Root, in our discussion in Root, but this game, there's kind of like a contract with every player that you have to punish players who try to overreach with acquiring magic in this game. Because if you just let somebody go you know, wild collecting as much magic as they want unchecked, then they are probably going to win the game.
Yeah, this is a game where you kind of go into it being like, you know, everybody kind of has to fight wars to keep the game going. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes it's in everyone's best interest to keep the player who's rushing magic down.
Right. Because mana is so good, elves are probably one of the strongest factions in this game,
because elves have abilities that let them spend mana as any other resource.
There's a couple factions that will only care about like one resource for ore. That's the dwarves, obviously, and for mana, that's elves. And they make mana very efficient. They acquire mana at a faster rate than other players. They're just all around incredibly good at managing mana. They make the most valuable resource even more valuable. They get more value out of it.
So in that instance, you would want to play very aggressively against the elf player.
Mm-hmm. You don't want them to, it's like patrol. If they move a unit out of a forest, if they ever leave a forest with just one unit in it in like the first round of turns, then the next action should be questing into that region and fighting it.
Yeah.
Like, or I think maybe not so aggressive. Leaving somebody with one unit early on in the game is a little annoying, or is a little mean. But definitely you never want to let somebody, especially an elf player, but probably anybody, control 3 forests on the board.
Right. Because every collection action, like, so since the highest cost for mana is 5, every collection action is most likely to get them 1.5 or, you know, 3/4 of the way to the next tier.
Also, just three of the actions that aren't gaining mana or, you know, patrolling or moving, three of those actions, if you just spend those gathering resources, will get you to your maximum, which there's a maximum of 9 resources that any player can have, or 9 of a resource.
Yeah.
For each player. So if you have 3 forests, then you take 3 turns gathering and now you have maximum mana.
Yeah. And so, then so like you can no one fight can, or whatever.
Yeah. You can fight. You have enough mana that you could probably win any war and still upgrade your magic. You have enough mana that if researching is the last action for this round and the first action for the next round of actions, you can afford any 2 magic upgrades
with
9, including your final 2.
So in that regard, it's also worth noting that you often can't knock somebody down by yourself in war because, so like for elves, for example, if they have 9 mana and you have whatever, they can probably still beat you in at least the first fight. And then you'll be down some resources or a meeple or something. So you often do have to work together to take down these people in the lead.
Right.
Which is worth noting.
Yeah. So if someone's in the lead, you kind of have to politic a little bit here. But you would, if you see, you know, somebody controlling 3 mana sources and they have a bunch of mana and they're approaching their 4th or 5th upgrade, then it's fair in this game, I think, to, you know, say to the board, like, this player is about to end the game. They're in a very strong lead right now. We should try to take them down a peg before that happens. So, you know, if you could please, or I'll take the quest action and we're just going to attack every territory we can, every region we can.
Right. Let's see.
Unfortunately, you know, even if they control 3 forests, sometimes that means that they could, like, they can maybe win one, they can maybe take the L on another, and then when it comes to them, they can just, like, collect resources and get all their mana back. But having lost a meeple sometimes is enough to swing things in your favor. If that delays the end of the game by a turn, then that's pretty big, because less meeples means less resource collection, so they might not be able to, you know, make up that difference the next round, or they, you know, they just might lose a little bit of tempo and you might just gain that much tempo.
Right.
Your minion advantage.
It is worth noting that, yeah, the 1-point difference can be big because there is so few points to be made in a given game of Tiny Epic Kingdom. Mm-hmm. And if somebody is researching 3 straight turns, you can easily build your tower for 3 straight turns and start getting to where you're getting more points per round.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, your build actions are giving you more points than their research actions.
Right. Now, another important piece of delaying the end of the game, which is a sort of important thing if you're not focusing on mana. Another way of doing that is by taking the action that player is concerned with at a moment when they can't afford it. So, like, say they've spent mana in a recent turn to upgrade their magic, and then it comes to you, the board is cleared, and they are left they're left in a place where they can't afford the next level of magic. You should take it then, even if you can't take it. You should try to take it, just so that it delays the game for another essentially 4 turns.
Exactly, yeah. You can use those 4 turns to catch up on points or fight or what have you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can kind of think of this game in a number of rounds, each round being 5 actions, and the game will end during one of those rounds, but you can very clearly tell which of those rounds it's going to happen on, and you can try and adjust that, you know, with these methods that we're talking about, by taking the action when people can't afford it or by attacking them before they get a chance to take the important action for that round.
Right, yeah. Let's see. So as far as when you should collect, I think a good rule of thumb is at least 2 times per round. Like, try to figure out some opportunities you can, just because you don't want to be down on resources, because everybody else taking actions, you know, we said, like, you want to take an action when other players can't benefit from it, so you want to minimize the chances that happens to you. So
It's sometimes an option just to, like, when the player forcing magic takes a research action, you collect some mana, and then when it comes around, you can take the research action while they're at a deficit, and now you can actually pay for it.
Yeah.
That sort of thing happens a lot with all of the expansion actions, like research, build, and expand, just because you can't always be doing all of them every round. It's just not possible, unless you somehow have, like, six meeples on the board, I guess. Yeah. So it's just going to naturally happen. Like, someone will take the expand or build action, and you're not really focusing on that, so you don't have it at the time. You'll just collect one of those, or two of those will usually be the chances when you will gather resources.
Right, yeah. Or, I mean, oftentimes if you don't have an immediate need to move, like, you don't need to position yourself to get a given resource, or you don't need to position yourself to fight, those are also good.
Or you don't need to defend or make space for a new meeple.
Right. Those are also good times to collect as well. And it should be worth noting that putting two meeples on a space makes that space safe. You just get one less resource.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking about really focusing on mana players for most of the game, for like the early, mid game, going into the late game. But there's a point in the game where you need to shift your focus from these mana players to somebody who's been building their tower.
Right.
Because if somebody gets level 5 of their tower, then that immediately puts them in contention for being, you know, the person to win the game. Regardless of who ends the game. Because if someone were to reach level 5 of their tower and then somebody else were to finish their mana, like, the most amount of points that someone can get, bonus points that someone can get from their fifth level of magic, is usually equal to the number of opponents, because it's usually based on something that your opponents have done, or your pieces in relation to your opponents, something positional. Anyways, so that's at most 1 point per opponent, and in a, you know, 4-player game, then that's like at most 3, but there's a chance that it probably won't be 3. And like we said earlier, when you're at level 5 of your tower, you get 7 points. So that's 2 bonus points. That's essentially as if the mana player had gotten 2 bonus points from their 5th level. So now it's essentially the same threat level. And if they're positioned to take their 6th level of their tower, that's real real shaky territory. You need to stop that.
Yeah, exactly. Because... and then if they get their 7th level of tower, there's no way you can stop them.
Mm-hmm.
That's almost a guaranteed win. Ruins are a trap. I don't think we mentioned how they actually work completely, but when you move a meeple into a ruin, you lay it face down, and while they're face down, you can gain resources, and it's like one of any resource when you collect. But then if you want to move that meeple off the ruins, you need to patrol first to stand it up, so they're not exploring the ruins. And when they're standing up, you can't get resources from there. And then after that, you can move the meeple off. So this is pretty bad, because it either means you have to spend an entire round of movement actions just to move that meeple off the board, or off that ruins, which means that you can't move around as much, you can't expand, you can't get the resources you need, you can't fight as much. Or you lose 1 point, which can be a huge deal.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes, like, you can get to the region you want a resource from in the same amount of moves as you can going to the ruins. And so, like, that flexibility that the ruin provides is not as good as just the everything else every other region provides.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the last piece of strategy I'd have is a piece that I don't really follow myself, but I should. And that's that you should try to keep a steady stream of food available to you.
Yeah.
Because expanding your population is another way to run away with the game, just because getting 4 resources versus 3 resources every turn is a big deal. Getting 5 versus 4 is a big deal. It's like having extra workers in a worker placement game, sort of. I guess not
it's
really.
It's just economy. You want to have good economy.
Yeah, it's just really good economy. And that kind of economy will then feed into the other growths. And it might not be, you know, as even as someone who's focusing, just because you're still dealing with the turns or the rounds of actions. So even if you're getting a lot of resources, you can't. Oh, it should also be said that you can't do an action multiple times. Like you can't upgrade your tower twice in the same turn. You can't upgrade your magic twice in the same turn.
You can't make more than one meeple in the same turn. Yeah.
Right. So because of that, somebody who has a lot of resources from having a lot of meeples isn't going to be able to like catch up per se. But if you have a lot of meeples, maybe that means that you can go for all 3 growth options. So somebody who's going for magic and not really meeples or ore is just that. They're not going for meeples or ore. But somebody who's going for meeples can go for the other 2 growth options pretty easily because they get a lot of resources. So they can probably research and build every chance they get.
Right. They can also fight wars a bit better because they have more resources to spend towards those wars.
Right. And really, everybody should have at least a good amount of food in their inventory so that they can sandbag a war.
Yeah, they can lose without spending their mana or ore and then keep the meeple alive.
Right, because sometimes when you go to fight somebody, like you have the option to lowball it to only spend 1 resource or to spend 0 resources and choose the flag option. But because you're attacking them, you could sort of present it as you're threatening them, you're threatening to take away their meeple. And because of that, you're kind of forcing the defender to think about how many resources they should spend. They might overestimate how many resources they should spend. In some cases, you can bluff them, make them spend a bunch of resources, and you could spend none. But if you're ever intentionally losing a war, you need to have the food so that you can keep your meeple on the board. Because fighting a war, making them spend their resources, but losing your meeple can be very detrimental.
Right, yeah. And it should be mentioned that if you have 1 meeple left, nobody can fight wars with you, and you can't fight wars with anybody else, meaning you can't even move into their regions.
Mm-hmm. Which, if you have 1 meeple left, you've probably already lost the game.
Yeah.
Because having 1 meeple is just not enough to do anything. That means that if you need to upgrade, if you need to do 1 of the advancement options, then you need to sit in a region and collect resources for, like, I don't know. I guess it's 2 turns for another meeple.
Well, I was going to say,
but
this is why I think, as far as starting resources go, you should probably at least start with 3 food.
Yeah.
Just so that in case someone does try to kill you on the first movement or the first quest, then you can expand again and you're not too far back. So, yeah, I think that's it for strategy for me.
Okay.
Try to figure out what your faction does. This is a game where the flavor of the faction can kind of tell you how they work.
Mm-hmm. Also, I guess, be prepared to fight wars.
Yeah.
Because fighting other players can be, you know, I guess some people are less inclined to do that in board gaming.
Yeah,
this is a game where you kind of have to.
Yeah, this is not a passive friendly game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so design.
Okay, so I want to start this off by saying something about the Tiny Epic series. So these games are all sort of designed with the same intention, which is to provide a condensed version of another genre or board game style. In this case, it's something like Terra Mystica or Scythe, like a faction-based, asymmetric, resource-gathering, collection, expansion, civ-building type of thing, area control. like almost a 4x, but not quite. And with that in mind, we have a very easy lens to look at how they designed this game, which is handy for someone analyzing design. And so we can look at like how what key points they isolated as like this is the essence of the type of game we want to make. In this case, we see that they have, you know, economy and worker building and, you know, getting more workers and people. In this case, it's the expand option. There is building up just general points, and that's the tower. And then there is like a tech tree or tech upgrade or ability upgrades, and that's the magic. And then, There's, of course, war.
Area control.
Yeah.
Yeah. Board.
Yeah.
And then part of economy is the resource management.
Exactly. Where
you're thinking like, how much do I spend on war? How much do I need to save for these different advancements?
Right. And so each of the like main actions is sort of given their own spot on the action card. So like, you know, the three expansion actions, those all have their own spots, and those all are like their own key concepts. And then war could be stated as having two spots, the quest and patrol. So in a way, like each part of the card is dedicated to one of those key concepts. Each resource is dedicated to one expansion action and then war as well in some capacity.
Mm. And then the final action is economy. It's the trade action.
Right, yeah. And then also, like, the fact that you can end the game by going to the end of any of these paths means that they think that different endpoints or, like, different ways to win is a key part of these games.
Mm-hmm.
And as
those remind me of, like, the Civilization game, the video game.
Yeah.
Where there's, like, the war path, the tech path, and the religious path.
Exactly.
It's sort of a similar three branching paths to reach the end of the game.
Right, yeah. And so in this way, like, I think they implemented these pretty well.
This is, I mean, as far as
giving them weight and making it the purpose of the game.
It's very distilled, but there's still, like, a good amount of depth to each of the different trees. Like the fact that the ore tree becomes a huge threat at the end of the game. But at the beginning of the game, it seems pretty unappetizing to invest resources and time to upgrading it. And the meeple tree, the population expansion option, it's the most expensive. And so people also similarly disregard it at certain points in the game. They'd rather not have to save all those resources, but it feeds into everything else in the game. It makes you better at war, at area control, at collecting resources and doing the other advancements. And then with the magic, like we said, there's so much threat and value in mana in this game. Even though it seems just as simple as like you collect mana and then you spend mana to get magic, and that's like the end of the mechanics.
Yeah. Everything ties together too, which is a good way of making use of limited space, both in components and in rules. It's sort of I've used this term, I think, on a recent episode as well, but it's sort of roguelite-y in that every mechanic works with the other mechanics in some way.
I'm not sure if you could call that, like, from roguelites. I imagine that idea stems from something else.
Well,
I like to picture it as like a web, like everything is connected to every other thing. Like, you know, types of terrain are connected to magic abilities, are connected to how you gain resources, are connected to how you fight wars.
Right. Well,
and
so
it's
like,
all like actually like referenced in each ability. Like the words reference the other parts of the game.
Right. I mean, like, the reason I say it's like Rogue is because in the original Rogue, you could throw any item and it would do different things. You could use items and drink items and it would do different things. You know, you could throw a potion, you could drink a potion. You could also throw a bottle of water, you could drink a bottle of water, etc. But anyways, It is very connected, which is a very smart way to use that limited space. And it is worth noting that the Tiny Epic Games' other point is to, you know, be like a space-effective, cost-effective, shelf-effective. You know, these are pretty small boxes.
Mm-hmm.
It's not quite a micro game, but micro games as like, you know, a very small game that is light on components but still has depth is much more of a thing in recent history. You know, there's stuff like cigar box games or gum tin games or whatever, mint tin, whatever, mm-hmm. where it's just like limiting the amount of physical space you have for the game. And so stuff like the fact that instead of a board, there are cards is part of that. It saves on cost and space in box and table and shelf and whatever. Mm-hmm. But it still has the same element of like, these are terrain that is closer to you and it's a bit safer because your meeples are more condensed, so you can gather them up and play defensively versus mm-hmm. questing is riskier and is more threatening because you're moving closer to their meeples. And the space of the board is still represented by like the physical distance between cards in this case.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of having a big board, you have these cards that are, you know, a bit away from each other, you know, like a meter or whatever.
Right. The game actually like forces you to place them. Maybe not a meter. A meter is it's a pretty
long I'm bad at metric.
Probably about a foot or two away.
Okay.
From
I wanted to use card. Metric maybe because we have international listeners, but I'm bad at it. Okay. Half a meter.
Third of a meter.
Third of a meter. Sure.
But anyways, well, the game forces you because you need to put the tower card and the action card in the center of the table
so everyone can see them,
cards,
touch them.
Right. And those cards have, you know, a width. You can't overlap them. So your map cards will go sort of like a perimeter around those cards. And that just kind of forces all the map cards apart from one another.
Yeah, and it still gives like this physical weight on the table or physical distance. Mm-hmm. And when you pick up and move your meeple from one to the other, it still feels like they're moving a far distance. But right. it's like an illusion. It's a trick. It plays on you.
We're talking about how this condenses a larger genre of the game. It also condenses it on time because
game.
Yeah, it's a civilization game. That genre is a very glacial genre. The games take hours to beat or to complete, I should say. And this game only takes, you know, a couple minutes. I think the box says like 30 to 45 minutes to finish a game, but it could go even quicker than that if you know what you're doing.
Right.
And one of the factors that does this is the constant action model where one player chooses an action, and these are very simple, fast actions. They're, you know, move a piece, collect a resource, make an upgrade. But everybody else does them at the same time as the active player.
Right. Yeah.
So that constant, everyone's doing something on every turn, reaches an end state much quicker.
And the end states, the things that allow you to finish the game, are pretty resource efficient, so like it doesn't take too many resources to complete those, so it doesn't take too long of a time collecting resources, which means there's more chances for players to do things that aren't just getting resources.
Mm-hmm.
And the pace of the game and the frequency at which you don't have to collect really ramps up quickly. Since, like, three meeples can mean you can fill up your resources in three turns of collecting, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the speed really helps, or the pacing really helps with that. Like, the
also,
pacing curve.
Because all of the actions are very simple and easy to, you know, understand and plan for, it's very easy to make the decision whether you're going to take that action or collect resources.
Right.
You know, you don't have to weigh much at all to make come to that decision when you're like, should I move or should I collect resources? You think like, well, do I need to fight anybody right now? No. Do I need to defend any place? No. Okay, I'll collect resources. Or even when it comes to upgrades, it's usually just like, can I afford it? No, I'll take resources.
Yeah, so like in that regard, the game really clearly telegraphs risks for every given action to the player. So like you can see really quickly that like getting one more resource is a big deal. So playing defensively quickly is shown to be much slower but safer, because as soon as somebody loses a war, you'll see how important that loss is. And so like whether or not you split your meeples up and play defensively, like it can take just one round around the table to actually highlight that importance. Mm-hmm. So the game really quickly, just during your first playthrough, will show you how important things are, for the most part. And like the fact that mana has the highest number on your faction, because every faction card has a little reminder of what each resource produces in war. So you'll pretty quickly realize, like, wait a minute, mana is the best one for war. I want to get some more mana.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of risks, one risk that that didn't really come up often, but still is part of the game, is that by making a mana or building upgrade at early stages of the game, at least, will leave you with less resources for fighting wars. It makes you vulnerable.
Yeah.
Because those are how you spend, those are what you spend to win wars. Do you have anything else with regards to comparisons to other Civilization games?
No, not in that regard.
Okay, so now we're just going to get into more general design discussion about this game.
Yeah. So, one thing I really like is the action selection card is really smartly arranged. At least in my opinion. So the patrol and movement are at the top relative to, you know, text alignment. And, you know, these are the ones that you're probably going to do first so that you can split up your first two meeples. And, you know, just splitting up meeples generally leads to literally every other action, since you get more resources of different types and whatnot. And then you can expand and all that. And then the three building options are kind of collected together. And the fact that they have colors that aren't anywhere else on that card makes them really stand out. Mm-hmm. Especially when you put shields next to them, just like the contrast of the gray and the green, or gray and the brownish red, kind of just makes them highlighted more, gives them more importance. And then trade is the last one because it's useful, but it's not a focus. It's not something you often take as like an intention.
I think it's fair to say trade is probably the weakest of the actions. It's usually the one you take when you're the active player and you can't do any of the other actions.
Yeah, and for us,
you don't want to do nothing.
For us, it's been the one that doesn't get chosen, since you don't take every action every time you place all the shields down.
I played a game as the dwarves, and I would take it every now and then to convert, because dwarves just get a bunch of ore from anything they do. So sometimes I would use it to just convert that ore into something a little more useful. It's also, I guess, useful for somebody who's maxed out on a resource.
Yeah, I took it a few times as elves, just so I have like the food at hand to be able to, you know, like fight a war and then lose or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that was before, of course, I got the upgrade for it. But yeah, it is
generally the weakest, the last choice that you would make. And because of that, it's last on the list.
Yep. Let's see. So, one problem I have, though, is that mana is too powerful. I mean, like, we talked about how powerful it is already. I don't think it's a good idea to have it so powerful, mainly because, really just because of the war. I'm interested to see what would happen if you switched ore and mana producing war cost.
Yeah.
Because ore is kind of just for the tower, which it feels like very few factions care about ore in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, it gives you a lot of points if you upgrade it a lot, but I don't know. It feels like
ore is the it provides the least benefit in over the course of the game to a player for acquiring it. I mean, because food, it's used for making units, which will then give you more resource and more board presence. It's also used to save your units after a combat. magic, we've talked about what mana does. It does everything, or does like one thing, and it there's no like function to it.
Yeah,
there's no mechanical benefit to doing it.
And as sort of a just a referring back to comparing it to Civ games, usually ore is used for weaponry in those types of games.
Right.
So like it has, or fortification, so it has some sort of element in combat. Whereas mana is closer to like just research in those types of games.
Right. I can see that the intention might have been just to say like this thing just takes all of your investment and it can eventually pay off big time. But it just turned out that the pacing of the game, the way it is, that usually doesn't come in every game.
It is true. Payoff. Also that the tower doesn't pay back into everything else as far as during the game. And it does give you those huge points at the end. Yeah.
It gives you points and it's use or can be used in war, but you can't really depend on it because you can wager up to 11, but you can only have up to 9 ore. So, yeah. So other than paying for war costs, ore does nothing, and having a high level tower does nothing over the course of a game. It only matters at the end of the game.
Yeah.
Because mana is so strong that it might be intentional.
Yeah, there's like a key.
There's like an arms race for mana.
Yeah, there's an obvious thing to fight over. It's a place of power.
Exactly. Places of power are kind of important in these board control games. In Scythe, that's the factory at the center of the board. And to a lesser extent, the encounters. Because that will force conflict on the players. And conflict is a key part of this game. Fighting wars is a very integral part of this game.
Right. You got to make your players want to fight.
Exactly. And so the existence of mana and the power of mana and how quickly it can end the game and how good it is for players it made us come to the conclusion that if somebody is forcing mana, you need to attack them early on as, you know, a collective, you know, opponent.
Yeah.
They'll take the game away.
Yeah, I do wonder if because mana is so strong, it does help the playtime.
Mm-hmm. That's also true. Maybe they made it so strong because they didn't want the game to be too long. So they're just like, yeah, mana can end the game very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess in that regard, it makes sense. I think if you were to design a new game like this, you would want to think about that decision.
Yeah.
But it is worth noting.
Yeah, come up with something that's a little... The problem with it is that it's just so strong, but that's not immediately obvious when you just go over how to play the game.
Yeah.
You just kind of... It seems like it just kind of comes up, like, somebody will say, I'll pick mana for this game. And then they'll start doing it, and then they'll realize that they are the strongest military power, they're the closest to ending the game and getting a bunch of bonus points. It's unfortunate that will just kind of come up naturally in a game. Although, like we said, it's possible that mana was included to encourage combat. And on the front of encouraging combat, that is something that the designers are doing. They're trying to get you to fight because we did a little analysis of all the factions this game.
We didn't even mention that.
All but three factions have combat abilities.
And half of the factions in the game have two combat abilities.
Right. How many factions in the game are there, by the way?
Oh, I didn't check. I think it's like either 13 or 15. It's an odd number.
Okay.
Because when 15... we counted them, there's one called the Shapeshifters that just get other faction abilities, and we didn't count those. And then there was an even split between the rest of them.
I think 15 sounds right.
Yeah.
Three of the factions don't have any combat, and then, like we said, like the rest of the factions, 12 factions, have combat abilities. If you were to shuffle and deal factions to characters to players randomly in a 4-player game, at least one player is going to have a war ability guaranteed, and it's more than likely that half of the players have at least two war abilities.
Yeah, or that only one player doesn't have a war ability at all.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it's more likely somebody will have war.
What's more, of the 12 factions that have war abilities, 6 of them, that ability is the first one they unlock. Yeah. So that it's sort of guaranteed to happen that somebody will get some sort of benefit in war. And, you know, if anything, a player is probably going to be encouraged to make use of these abilities to get that value that they've unlocked. So they're going to use it. They're going to fight wars. War is now encouraged in the game.
Right. Oh, in that regard, I forgot to mention that every faction's mana pathway or whatever, their upgrades are structured pretty much the same way, which I think is nice. Mm-hmm. So, like, the first tier is usually just resource efficiency. Either you mm-hmm. spend resources in a different way, you get them better, or you spend them in war a bit better. Mm-hmm. Second tier is usually pure war power. That's usually where the combat ability goes, if there's only one. Or if there is two, that's one of them. The third mm-hmm. one is usually, like, the keystone mana ability. Like, this is your faction's special thing that you can kind of build around. And then same with the fourth one, that's usually a stronger version that ties together with the third tier. And then the fifth tier is points that you get for doing what the other abilities let you do. Or, like, right. you know, it rewards you for playing your faction in a specialized way.
Right. In the case of dwarves, their third ability was you build at one ore cheaper, and their fourth ability was you can build instead of trading.
Right, yeah.
And their fifth ability was you get a point for every person who had a lower level tower than you.
Right.
So that's sort of an example of how that will play out for one strategy.
Exactly, yeah. And then also, I do think it is nice, this is the type of game where the factions kind of tell you what to do. There is flavor that educates the strategy. You mm-hmm. know, goblins like to populate themselves and then fight a lot. Orcs just like to stomp on people. Dwarves hole up in their mountain and build a tower. You know, the Tritons like to walk on water and fight wars near water. Stuff like that.
Are they Tritons in this game?
Oh,
or are they just merfolk?
They might just be merfolk.
Tritons is the small world name.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Same thing.
Speaking of that, small world is a...
Oh, I had one more strategy point. One more design point.
Version of this game. Go ahead.
Just that the option to have different starting resources just adds replayability and doesn't really subtract much from the base game. Because the starting amount is still very good, and like the starting amount lets every player do each expansion action once and then mm-hmm. have one mana left over for combat. So it kind of also shows that mana is strong in combat.
Mm-hmm.
And it also means that every player can be completely involved in the first round because of that. Since everybody can do each action once with the starting amount, every player right. can do any action anybody chooses in the starting round. Which is just nice for a first playthrough. Mm-hmm. But then once you have that first playthrough down and you realize how each resource works, it gives you this carrot on a stick to be like, why don't you try a different strategy?
Why don't you just take 6 food or yes. 6 mana?
Yes, excellent. So that.
All right.
Okay.
That's all I have for notes.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Similar games. Any Civilization game?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, just figure... I think, and when it comes to those, you just kind of pick a subject or genre, you know? There's, like, historical civilization, fantasy, there's, what is it, like...
Oil steam? Punk is...
Oil punk.
I think yeah, it's oil punk is what I would call it.
Mm-hmm. There's ones with big boards, there's ones with no boards, in the case of Through the Ages...
There's ones with fairy tale creatures in the case of Root.
Yeah, so if you want to play more Civilization games, check them out. This is certainly a cheap, affordable, you know, introduction to the genre. And like we said, it saves space. So, yeah. And with that, that'll be the end of our episode discussing Tiny Epic Kingdoms. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
If you'd like to hear more, you can follow us on any podcasting platform. You can leave us some comments and reviews there if you'd like. If you have a suggestion for a game or a topic you'd like us to cover, you can hit us up on social media, on Facebook and Twitter at BGBrosCast. You can go to our website, bgbcast.com, where we have all of our episodes cataloged, and we have them tagged with the games that we discuss in them. We did an episode on Scythe, so if you want to check that episode out, you can find it on our website.
We also did an episode on Small tags. World.
We did, yeah. The game that we just confused a little bit of this game with. Also on our website, you can find a link to our TeePublic store where we sell t-shirts with our cool logo on it. That's teepublic.com/user/BGBcast. And that does it for BG Bros plugs, so let's hear from Matt plugs.
All right. I write articles under the Episodes and Articles tab of the BGB website. My most recent article is about Enter the Gungeon and how its flavor educates game design. I have been working on an article on the game Anodyne, and I'm going to be streaming its sequel, Anodyne 2, on my Twitch page on twitch.tv/twack, twitch.tv/twak. I stream on most weekdays from 11 a.m. Central Time to 2 p.m. Central Time, give or take an hour or two. I stream single-player games that often have puzzles or exploration or whatnot. I stream competitive games like fighting games like Rivals of Aether. I speedrun a few games like the game Hob, and I'm learning to speedrun The Witness. And you can also follow me on Twitter at MattCraigGaming to get updates when I go live. There's also a Discord server in the Twitch page description where you can talk to both of us and other fans of the stream and the podcast about different subjects or what have you, or get updates when I go live, and etc.
All right, that does it for Matt plugs, and that does it for our episode. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.
See ya.